surprise y'all. It's Anti-War Radio, Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton. And I got a pretty good show lined up for you today. Four interviews, all show long, starting off with our good friend Eric Margolis. You know his website is ericmargolis.com. Spell it like Margolis, and you'll find it there. He's a foreign correspondent for Sun National Media, author of War at the Top of the World, and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
Well, I'm happy to be back with you, Scott.
All right, so basically, I haven't even had a chance to review your articles lately. I just want to get your expert commentary on and perspective on all these different things, you know, on fire, breaking out all over the world. First of all, in Somalia, yesterday there was some kind of incursion. I guess they're saying the narrative is it was a limited one, a helicopter strike against some terrorist. But I wonder, you know, what you know about that and what you think that portends for the future of American policy in Somalia.
Scott, I've been following America's deepening involvement in Somalia for the last 4 years, really with considerable interest and concern. Somalia has fallen apart. It's in chaos. It's got no central government. It's ruled by, it's being fought over by warring clans. It's a very dangerous place. It's also become a safe haven for all kinds of anti-American groups and wanted men. You know, the story we're told that if we don't hold on to Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, the terrorists will be in New York. We have to deny them training grounds. Well, Somalia is a perfect training ground for all kinds of violent extremists. What's happened is that after more than a decade of civil war, the Somalis finally managed to cobble together a government. It was an Islamist government. It was called the Islamic Courts Union, and it was an Islamist light government. But it was the most popular government. The U.S. then colluded under cover of Christmas a few years ago with Ethiopia, which is a close American ally, big recipient of American aid, to invade Somalia, overthrow this fairly popular government. Since then, there's been utter chaos. The Somalis are fighting the Ethiopian invaders. The U.S. has bribed a bunch of African countries to send mercenaries, but they don't want to fight. And meanwhile, the U.S. has been staging steady series of raids into Somalia with commandos and aircraft and Tomahawk cruise missiles, and the last one being yesterday, where it killed a leading anti-American leader, Saleh Nabahan.
Huh. Well, a couple of things there. First of all, is it right that the Obama administration and the Bush administration at the end of their term, not that this is, you know, some Obama commie pro-Islam policy or something, this is, I think he inherited this situation from Bush, and that is that we are now backing the guys that ran the Islamic Courts Union that Dick Cheney hired the Ethiopian army to overthrow Christmas 2006 because the Ethiopians lost and were driven out, basically, and the Islamic Courts Union guys were going to win one way or another. So now they've inherited the shell of the phony government that America and the UN and Ethiopia had created, and now they're fighting off the people who are even more radical than them, who they had allied with to fight against the Ethiopians and the American Special Forces or whatever. So now we're backing the guys that we overthrew in order to protect them from the guys who are even crazier than them, who helped them to defeat us. Right.
Well, that sums it up in a nutshell. I think it's a good analysis.
Yeah, I'm going to get a Ph.D. in killing Somali studies, I guess.
It's a very confused situation in a country where everybody's stoned a good part of the time because they chew cot down there in a narcotic shrub in Somalia and Yemen. And I've been there, and at noontime every day, everybody has lunch, and then they go and chew this narcotic weed till late afternoon, and everybody wanders around stoned and then shoot their guns. And
that doesn't sound so bad.
It should be a fun place, but unfortunately, it's so violent that, well, the crazy thing is that the head of the Islamic militants called Shabab, that's going to be the new dirty word up there with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, Shabab, which really are not part of Al-Qaeda, even though they keep saying that. The former head of it was put into power by the Americans, backed by a lot of money, and he set up there are two phony shell governments now in Somalia, but they're just creatures of the West, and meanwhile everybody else is fighting with everybody else. It's a place that we should not be involved in. It is an absolute mess. Nobody can figure it out.
Well, yeah, and you know, I should bring up here in case I forget it later that, and I don't know too much about this, maybe you can fill us in, but I have read some reporting about how European and I guess American companies have used Somalia as a dumping ground, not just for their toxic waste, but for nuclear waste, because there's no authority. You know, it's commonly owned water there, but nobody has any enforcement power over it, so they just dump whatever they want.
Well, I've heard that too, you know, a lot of the Somalis were saying, well, wait a minute, you accused us of piracy, but our pirates, our fishermen are fighting back against the people who are not only polluting our territorial waters, but they're strip mining it of fish that we used to live on. Now all these trawlers come in, there's nobody to tell them to get lost. So the country is definitely being despoiled, and it's dangerous, you know, it's infecting the whole part of East Africa. And what it's also we see in this, Scott, a growing American presence in Africa. And these things, you get mission creep, as we saw in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and we now have a West African command. That's why President Obama went to Ghana, because that's where it's going to be based.
Well, and you know, the thing is, I think when they divided the earth up, the Pentagon, into all the different commands, divisions after World War II, Africa was divided into, I guess, two different commands or something, as, you know, just subsets of the Middle Eastern Authority or the European Authority or however they called it, South Atlantic Authority or whatever it was. But now Africa as a continent has its own command under the Pentagon's new map.
That's right.
Not that they're betraying their intentions there or anything. They just want to help the people, you know, well, HIV and all that.
There are more and more American forces being special forces, special units being deployed in both West Africa and in East Africa and the Horn of Africa and around Djibouti. And not only Americans, the French are also mixed up in things. There's some French agents were just caught in Somalia. One of them escaped.
Well, now, you talked about how al-Shabaab is not really al-Qaeda, but they say that this guy that they killed yesterday was the connection between the two, that he was supposedly, and I like the framework for this, he was wanted for questioning by the FBI, the federal police. You know, they're going to read him his rights and interrogate him and see if maybe get a grand jury to indict him and put him on trial, that kind of thing. But instead, they just blast him out of the air, and so I guess part of my question is, what's the legal authority for this? Fox News is saying Obama signed an executive order saying it's okay to murder these people in Somalia. I'm not sure, you know, if that's under the authorization to use military force passed after September 11th or what. But also, it reminded me that the Washington Post reported back in Christmas 2006 when this started that the official reason for it was that there were three Al-Qaeda suspects wanted for questioning by the FBI. Suspects, Eric, wanted for questioning for a possible role that they may have played in the Africa embassy bombings of 1998. And this is what is the excuse for starting this war in the first place. And now, you know, Obama proving that you know, he's just like Dick Cheney, I guess, and is willing to go along with whatever the Pentagon wants, or maybe it's what he wants, I don't know.
Well, as Osama bin Laden just said, it seems that Obama is almost like helpless, and that he's being, you know, prisoner of these powerful forces in Washington that are directing policy. Now, the U.S. has every right to go after the people who bombed the embassies in East Africa in 1998, killed a huge amount of people. It was a terrible crime. But whether, you know, I question whether the U.S. has any legal authority to go murdering people anywhere around the world. Just imagine if Somalis or Palestinians or Afghans decided to come to the United States and start killing American politicians who've authorized war against their country. Would be the same thing, but we wouldn't call it that. We would call it terrorism.
Yeah. Well, so do you put any stock at all in the idea that, you know, maybe the people who fought to resist Dick Cheney's war over there for the past few years have been, you know, ferrying across to the Arabian Peninsula and hanging out with their Al-Qaeda buddies and getting training and weapons and ideological brainwashing and whatever? I mean, we've seen suicide attacks there in a country that had never experienced them before.
there's a lot of action going on in Yemen, in the north of Yemen, an area called called Ma'arib Sa'ada in the north Yemen, and there are a lot of anti-American groups in Yemen. That's, of course, where the Bin Laden family comes from, and who are very militant. They're fighting the U.S.-backed Yemeni dictator, General Saleh, and there is considerable intercourse between Yemen and Somalia, which is just across the water. So there are movement of militants back and forth. There always have been. But to say this is all part of a giant al-Qaeda plot is stretching it wildly. I mean, and what they always say is terrorists linked to al-Qaeda. Well, you know, I met Osama bin Laden. I was with Taliban. I was with a lot of these people in Afghanistan. That would make me linked to al-Qaeda, too.
And I guess me, too, since I've interviewed you a dozen or two times, right?
Now, you're in the doghouse, and I have no sympathy for al-Qaeda.
And all my listeners.
That's right.
And everybody that they know.
That's right. Pack your sombrero. You're going to Guantanamo.
Oh, no. Well, look, and boy, we'll be getting to that at the bottom of the hour. Y'all want to know about Guantanamo. Stay tuned for that. But so Osama bin Laden put out another message back in the summer of 2006, and it said, hey, everybody, the Crusaders are on their way to Somalia and to Sudan. Meet them there and kill them. And so, you know, as you just said, it, you know, everybody has their conspiracy theories about September 11th. I'm starting to think that Osama bin Laden is actually the secret mastermind controller of the American government, and that George Bush and Dick Cheney and now Barack Obama all just take their orders from him. Like, let's see, he's writing a script. Let's make sure it comes true so that he becomes right after the fact. What the hell is that?
Well, Scott, there is a school of thought that that bin Laden very cleverly laid out a grand strategy that he put into motion, into which a trap into which the U.S. completely stumbled. He said in earlier speeches that he said we have to drive the U.S. out of the Muslim world. The U.S. is a colonial power occupying our countries, corrupting our societies, and imposing dictators on us. We've got to drive them out. There's only one way that we weak Muslims can drive the Americans out, and that's by trapping, hitting them in their weak, in their Achilles heel, which is their economy. And the second thing is dragging them in all kinds of lots of little wars and bleeding them until they are defeated. Well, we have Afghanistan.
Hey, that's how the doctors killed George Washington. They bled him to death. I was just watching that on the History Channel the other day.
Good point. Jeez, I think my doctor tried to do that to me, too, the other day. Well, we have, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, now with the U.S. involved in three shooting wars. American troops are active in the Philippines. The U.S. is involved in Central Asia now and so forth. So this is exactly what's happening. And now Pakistan is becoming a new front. And bin Laden said that he mentioned specifically Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia, but he said the ultimate battle, America's ultimate battle that America would lose would be in Pakistan. And so far, what he has predicted seems to be coming true.
Well, and now let's get to the heart of that, because his best buddy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the doctor, the Egyptian doctor, former leader of Islamic Jihad, he put out a thing, and it was all about Pakistan. And it was basically urging all the people of Pakistan to rise up and overthrow their government, because after all, on its very face, everyone knows that the government there is simply a puppet of the United States waging war against their own people. And how dare they say they're an Islamic government, and yet all they do is kill Muslims and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, obviously I don't share the point of view that it's coming from, but I'm not so sure that any of the facts in there were in dispute, you know?
Well, you know, what's happening in Pakistan perfectly illustrates the views of a Pakistani thinker that I was reading, that he said that a Muslim army, armies of the Muslim states, have never won a war against a foreign invader. The only purpose they serve is to oppress their own people. And Pakistan's army is now sort of fitting into that theory. It has been rented, bribed, suborned, whatever you want to call it, by Washington to fight its own people, because Washington wants to involve Pakistan as a big mercenary force or sepoys, as they're known in that part of the world, to fight in Afghanistan and to fight the Pashtun tribes across the border in northern Pakistan. And the government resisted for quite a while, but has gradually given in. Pakistan's bankrupt, it's dirt poor, and Washington is just spreading billions of dollars around. It's bought all the leadership. And 95% of Pakistanis hate America's hate America intently, as I found there. I used to
Jeez, is it really like that now? 95%?
Maybe it's 98 by now, but
it
is right up there, and there's fury at the United States, and there people are screaming at the army, stop killing your own people.
And now tell people about Pakistan a little bit, because, you know, I mean, I know that you've told me in the past it's kind of sort of four semi-autonomous states all kind of faking it with one army and that kind of thing, but there are some major cities there, and this is a... this was a center of British imperial power for a long time, so there's very westernized culture there. I mean, I know a lot of Pakistanis, or I have known a lot of Pakistanis, and, you know, it's not, the caricature of what they think of when they think of Afghanistan, where everybody looks like they're out of the 7th century and they live in the town of Bedrock and so forth.
That's right. I mean, there are many sophisticated Pakistanis. It's a country of 170 million people, almost half of whom are illiterate, and the majority of whom live on less than $2 a day. And the problem in Pakistan, one of the big problems, is that Pakistan is a feudal country. It continues to be ruled by large landowners. And these landowners make up the judges and the government and provide the sort of the generals for the army. What the Americans are calling Taliban in Afghanistan is in part a tribal rising by the Pashtun tribes who don't want the military in their areas, but it's also growing a revolt against the landowners. Who it's like a nationalist uprising, a poor people's rebellion, who want to stop living in serfdom and poverty.
Mm. Yeah, and so all we're doing basically with the U.S. comes in with our own agenda. It has really nothing to do with their domestic politics and things they got to deal with. And we just spend billions and billions of dollars of the Chinese money in order to prop up this government that, you know, perhaps the people of Pakistan might be able to replace it with something more to their liking rather than something more to, you know, the guys with the black turbans liking. You know what I mean? But instead, it's almost like, you know, whatever, everything's just a metaphor and analogy. It doesn't work 100%. But it reminds me of what I've learned about the history of Vietnam and bombing Cambodia all the time till their government fell and was replaced by the Khmer Rouge, who were monsters out of the worst nightmare. So it sort of seems like that, where we have a situation, or we had a situation in Pakistan where, you know, at least they weren't at war with India, and things are going okay, and there's still lots of trade and money, and the economy there is developing and all these things. Instead, we're pushing them to the brink of falling completely apart, going to war with themselves and each other. And then, of course, this is the justification for more intervention, is because we can't have Pakistan falling apart, Eric.
That's exactly right. And we are pushing Pakistan over the brink, or the mixed metaphors. We're twisting Pakistan's arms so hard behind its back. Something's going to happen. There's going to be a revolt in the army by younger officers. There are going to be mass demonstrations in Pakistan. I just don't see this situation continuing. Everybody hates the government. They hate America. They're calling the government rulers stooges, quislings. The very wealthy 1% are stealing as much money as they can out of the country. And they're saying, oh, we're fighting for democracy and we're fighting to stop terrorism. The Americans don't give a damn. We really don't give a damn about what goes on in Pakistan or its plight. The only thing we want is to use that Pakistani army, in Afghanistan, and also to use Pakistani bases, because those bases, air bases, ground bases, truck routes, are absolutely necessary to wage the war in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just saw something on the foreign policy blog where they were talking about, you know, how the Russians said, oh, yeah, sure, you can use our old trails to be supply lines for your guys in Afghanistan, that is radicalizing all the people along those trails all up into Central Asia. It's pissing people off, and they're starting to fight, and of course then all the guns and all the everything else get to travel up and down the same routes, and they're just spreading the war.
That's right, Scott. The longer foreign forces are there in Afghanistan, the more resistance there's going to be to them. You know, and it's incredible when you think that the American military is there with 68,000 soldiers plus an equal number of NATO troops. We're using B-1 heavy bombers. We're using F-15s, F-16s, Apache gunships, every kind of electric gizmo, Predator drones, heavy artillery, rocket batteries, you name it. We're using the most modern military equipment against tribesmen who are armed only with light weapons. And yet we can't defeat them. And the question is why? Well, the why is because they're getting more and more people pissed off in Afghanistan. And as a British commander very rightly said, he said, you know, the Americans are never going to win in Afghanistan, he said, because they're so culturally ignorant that they simply have no understanding of this country or the people. And Washington is telling them to win the hearts and the mind of the Afghans, and yet our soldiers there are calling these people ragheads and sand fleas and things like that.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I'm so tired of hearing people say, well, geez, Obama's, he's a great guy, and he's trying real hard to clean up George Bush's mess, and you got to give him some time to do it. Well, he's just sending 20,000 troops, and then 20,000 more, and then 20,000 more, and then 20,000 more from now until the end of his first or second term, whichever it is, apparently. So I don't know how that's cleaning up anything other than just making the whole thing worse, as you said. And, you know, here's another thing I want to bring up along those same lines. I'm not sure if you've been reading the Global Post. There's a great journalist there, a lady named Jean McKenzie. I interviewed her on the show once, and I'm going to try to get her on the show tomorrow, I think. And she wrote this article about how, you know, where's the Taliban getting all their money? Well, they're getting all their money from U.S. aid, because all of the money that goes into so-called reconstruction and to the NGOs, and there are a lot of good people at NGOs trying to do good things and what have you, but all this money, they have to pay protection money to the Taliban to not kill them. And so they're just and it's built into the cost, right? You just put 20% on top, like that movie, The Tailor of Panama or whatever. Just, oh, it's going to cost $1 million. All right, it's going to cost $2 million. He tells the other guy. And then so the Taliban gets $1 million. And then the only solution to this is more nation building and more aid and whatever, which, you know, we're talking about a self-licking ice cream cone here, I think, is what the generals call it, right?
The Taliban levies of taxes on all the road transport. 98% or 97% of NATO supplies come in by truck through Pakistan and over the Khyber Pass and some other passes. And Taliban is just there, and they destroy some of them. The rest, they charge a road tax. So, yes, money's coming from there. It's coming from some Gulf Arabs who are supporting Taliban. It's coming from local collections. It's a popular resistance movement. And the allies are not going to cut off its money.
All right. Now, here's another, a couple headlines I just want to bring up and get your comment on. First of all is the vote fraud. And how politically can this government back a completely fraudulent government? I mean, they're not going to have... Well, you can explain the situation there. Tell us what you think about that.
Scott,
and then also, I just wanted to mention as well that Zbigniew Brzezinski has come out with this thing saying, well, there's this perspective in Afghanistan that we are foreign invaders. And boy, if they think that, then we can't possibly win there. They've got to think
of
that,
course,
you know, we're wonderful.
It took Zib all this time to figure that out. All the foreigners are called Farangs, relying to Frankish invaders during the Crusades.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah, the Franks.
What's the word? Teach farang, me that again.
Farangs.
I'm never going to figure that out. Go ahead.
Anyway, the election was a fraud within a fraud. The greater fraud was confected by the U.S., and its allies. And that was that you stage an election in which only individuals are allowed to run. No political parties were allowed to run in Afghanistan. Americans don't understand this. Nobody ever told them. Can you imagine running an election in the U.S. without any political parties? Well, that was to exclude anyone who opposed the Western presence there. If Taliban had been allowed to run as a party, it would have won the election. It's the most popular party in Afghanistan, but it's excluded. And only hand-picked candidates approved by the U.S. and its allies were allowed to run. Then the U.S. financed and staffed the election commission, which would count the votes. And then it funded a huge media campaign behind these candidates. So what you had was a predetermined election. But in the midst of this predetermined piece of political theater, you also had a second dishonesty, and that was that the ballot boxes were stuffed, and there was intimidation and everything else that was so embarrassing that the Western observers couldn't pretend it wasn't there. But that result is that it was a disgrace for all concerned. I wrote weeks before, I said, who's going to win the Afghan election? Whoever Washington decides will win.
And that's what you said on this show leading up to it, too. Yeah.
And the ultimate ruler of Afghanistan will be Barack Obama.
But so now, how can they pretend, though? I mean, you know, in Iraq, they were like, I mean, it actually was a situation where the Ayatollah Sistani won the election. That wasn't our plan, but they kind of forced us into it, whatever, whatever. You could call that somewhat a democracy, you know, in a way. Anyway, but this guy Karzai is just nothing but a puppet. Now he's got no legitimacy whatsoever. They held this election, and it took away whatever phony legitimacy he had from 2004.
You know, as they used to say about Somoza, Nicaragua, he's an SOB, but he's our SOB. And they don't have another candidate. Dr. Abdullah Abdullah was a much more attractive man. He's the Tajik candidate. And the Tajiks are so in bed with the drug dealers and the Afghan Communist Party that I don't even think Washington wants to touch them. It's scared of them.
I hope there's not some kind of DM-style coup d'etat and then they got nobody to replace him with.
Oh, they'll find some general. What they really want, what Washington really wants, is another Najibullah. He was the strong man who ran Afghanistan for the Soviets. And they want some real tough, mean bastard general in there who will run things, because Washington is not interested in good government in Afghanistan. It wants a compliant, obedient government.
Yeah. All right. Now, I got to keep you over, but also I got to go. So we got to do this pretty quickly here. But I guess during the break, I'm going to try to play at least some of this clip of Jim Traficant speaking out about the Israel lobby's influence over American foreign policy. And I almost can't believe it, even though everybody's been talking about and covering this, the march to war with Iran for years now, and all the people pushing for it in the pro-Israeli part of the war party there. I almost can't believe that anybody would even really be contemplating this as they're doubling down in Afghanistan and Pakistan, you know, maybe setting the stage for, you know, putting ground forces permanently in Somalia and all this kind of thing. But then again, I'm reading the Jerusalem Post, and they say, oh, man, the Israel lobby descended on Washington, D.C. last week to push for this thing. And I just wonder if I get you to address, give us your, how you measure Israel's influence in Washington, D.C., and what is the real danger that they would be able to really push for a blockade and maybe even a war in the name of a nuclear weapons program that we all know does not exist?
Well, there's no doubt that Israel's lobby in Washington is the most powerful in the United States and really is a co-partner, at least with the president, in making Middle East policy. If not a large, it really dominates Congress. The Israeli writer Uri Avneri put it beautifully. He said if the Israel lobby ordered Congress to, it would repeal the Ten Commandments. So that's a fact of life in Washington, and there is intense pressure, but there's pushback, as I found on my recent trips to Washington, from the Pentagon, from states, and from CIA, who are aghast at the thought of getting involved in another war and the dangers posed to U.S. interests by an attack against Iran. But President Obama is a thin reed, in my opinion, and doesn't seem very good at resisting power. I mean, here he thundered and ordered the Israelis to stop building settlements, And they laughed in his face, or spit in his face, depending on who you ask. I mean, and he let that go by without any comments. So he's shown maximum weakness. And I think this is going to continue, and I'm very concerned. We'll see how much, whether the bureaucracy in Washington can resist the political demands.
Well, and, you know, I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but this is really important. And I don't think, you know, even though it gets covered to death on this show, I don't think it gets covered that much in most places. And that is that in 1996 and 1998, when Osama bin Laden put out his fatwas, in all of his interviews with CNN and all the different the newspaper, Al-Quds something or other newspaper in London and whatever, he always mentioned Palestine. In fact, the first fatwa came right on the heels of Clinton kicking him out of Sudan to Afghanistan, and then the Qana massacre, which got a lot of coverage in that first fatwa, first Qana massacre, Israel and Lebanon in 1996 there. And anyway, so yesterday this supposed Osama tape came out, and I don't know whether to believe this or not. It seemed kind of strange the way it read, but then again, you know, who knows what. And here he recommends Walt and Mearsheimer and the Israel Lobby book, just as he supposedly at least has recommended people read Michael Scheuer's Imperial Hubris before, and is saying, one, that Obama is, as you said, you know, at the beginning of this, a weak, helpless before the power of the Pentagon to continue their wars. But he also really focused this message more than any other on the power of the Israel lobby in the United States. And I'll tell you what, you know, I think this clip of Jim Traficant I'm fixing to play at the end of this interview, you know, he states it. I think they both probably overstated a bit, but I don't know. What do you think?
I think Obama, Osama bin Laden, have always been an acute observer of American politics. And ever since 9/11, there's been a huge effort to tell Americans that the attack on 9/11 was due to any possible reason except the real one, and that is over Palestine and American support for the continued suffering of the Palestinians. And people stand on their heads to avoid saying that. There's a whole industry which generates books, Fuad Ajami's of the world writing books for the Wall Street Journal and stuff like that about how Muslims are sick and a deviant culture and Islam is a bad religion. No, it was over Palestine. So he's underlining that point. But one could counter that Obama really hasn't done much to help the Palestinians. And in fact, he may have hurt the whole Arab cause.
Well, and you know, here's the thing too, is screw Osama bin Laden. The guy's a murderer. You don't go around quoting Ted Bundy and what he says is important or true or whatever. But the point is that Mohammed Atta agreed with Osama bin Laden about what was going on in Lebanon and in Palestine. And that's why he was the lead hijacker. And that's the problem, is that, as Michael Scheuer says in Imperial Hubris, America's policy, particularly in Palestine, as listed on Al-Qaeda's list of grievances, is one of their main recruiting tools. They don't go around denouncing miniskirts. They go around denouncing Israel and Palestine and blaming America for it. And that's how they get people to agree with them and join up.
Well, Scott, my whole new book, American Raj, is just about this topic and how the Muslim world is furious at the U.S. And we continue to further enrage the Muslim world by doing various things rather than trying to solve the problem.
All right, everybody, that is Eric Margolies. You can find his website at ericmargolies.com. He's a foreign correspondent for Sun National Media. You can often find what he writes at lewrockwell.com and at antiwar.com. The books, again, are War at the Top of the World, which is read by all the intelligence agencies in the military, so maybe you ought to take a look at it. And also, American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Thanks very much for your time on the show today.
Pleasure as always, Scott. Cheers.